Welcome to Vital Connections On Air, a podcast brought to you by University of Minnesota Extension's Center for Community Vitality that explores the trends and topics important to communities and leaders throughout Minnesota. My name is Christy Kalavig, and I'm an educator with University of Minnesota Extension's Center for Community Vitality. We are back from our break, and I have a very special episode for you today. Actually, two episodes. Do you remember when Laura Kalambakidis, Minnesota State Economist and Extension Economist, said this about exploring Minnesota's workforce issues?
Makes me excited to see what 10 years from now will look like. And where hopefully what we've done is we've created more flexible jobs, and we've got people living in different places than they might have otherwise, and we've got people who might not have been in the workforce or are fully engaged in the workforce. Mm-hmm. And those, we've created those pathways and those connections between employers and organizations and the government and the community, and we've built those, and that stays part of our assets, our economic assets for the state of Minnesota. Imagine if Minnesota is the state that thrives in this interesting, new, diverse environment. It'll be an exciting place to study and work in.
This thought inspired us at the Center for Community Vitality. We had been exploring the topic of workforce for well over a year when I met with Laura, and she shared this in her podcast. But after a few more of us heard her dream, it ignited a conversation that we then took to the entire University of Minnesota and invited a large group of researchers to come together to talk about workforce, to think about what we can do better to understand the issue and how we can create change. Those in the room were given the responsibility to think like a scholar but care like a concerned citizen by Kent Olson, the Dean of the Center for Community Vitality. Out of this day, relationships were developed, new research ideas were explored, and connections into communities were created. The next two podcasts are a wrap-up from the symposium. In this episode, you will hear a variety of topics that weave together in a way that will help us to consider the human side of our workforce challenges. How will we share information? How do we prepare people for entering the workforce or even for possible displacement? How do we involve untapped pockets of potential workers to help us solve our workforce problems? We hope that this sampling will make you curious, and because of that, we have made the slides and all of the audio from the day available to you at z.umn.edu/workforcesymposium. You will also get to hear some flashbacks to previous guests who shared their insights during past workforce episodes. In episode 8 of our podcast, I was able to visit with Bob Kill from Enterprise Minnesota. As we talked about the future of our workforce, he brought up the impact of automation, both today and in the future.
Bring automation to bring safety and career growth to the industry. And it's, one of my pet peeves is people think automation is to replace people. It's not. It's to enhance the position, bring safety and career growth to the people that are there, because you just can't keep doing it the way you used to.
Mats Heimdall, professor and head of computer science and engineering at the University of Minnesota, joined the symposium. Here he discussed with us the future of work, and he encouraged us not to just accept automation, but think about how we're going to respond to it.
I work in software engineering, software development, and we have, of course, a lot of faculty working in all kinds of areas of computer science, and you read the literature, you listen to the news or whatnot, now you know that the future of work is going to be intimately tied together with artificial intelligence or augmented intelligence or what are the other words now you hear? There's a lot about autonomy, a lot about automation, a lot about intelligent this and that, smart everything, and so on and so forth. But this is really what you hear a lot about, right? And what we're hearing now is that this kind of automation, this kind of technology is going to drive out not the typical blue-collar manual labor, but we're looking at replacing doctors and pharmacists and drivers and all kinds of other things, and automating things that just weren't automatable before. And that gets people freaked out, right? So to keep this short and get us back on time, artificial intelligence, future of work, we're all screwed. Yeah, well, we don't want to beat around the bush here. It's just not working. So where is this leading us, right? That's really massive unemployment. That's what we're hearing. I mean, clearly, I'm going to talk a little more about what this AI and all this stuff really is, right? So people have an understanding of why this is not going to happen. There's going to be massive displacement of people. There's no question about that. There are whole categories of jobs that are just going to go away, like they always have, right? We've survived that. We're going to survive this too. It's just going to be, I think there are some fundamental differences this time, not in what's going to happen to the labor force, right? There's going to be displacement, but how we deal with it. Because it's the retraining aspects of this are not as simple as they used to be, I believe. So hopefully we're not going to go that way. So back to AI. What is artificial intelligence, really, or all this you read about? Now it's sort of a catch-all phrase for anything automation, right? You're going to automate your, do you use TurboTax? It provides suggestions. Maybe you should try this deduction. Maybe you should look at this, but that's AI, right? You have self-driving cars, that's AI. You have all kinds of things, that's AI. But what AI really is, it's traditional automation, factory automation, control systems, that we've done that since the beginning of time, really, automated certain kinds of tasks, right? That falls under AI now. AI is very good at search. You're searching for an answer to something, like you're searching for a good chess move. If you can just search far enough, you can always find the best chess move. The problem is we can't search that far. Well, now actually we can in chess, but we couldn't search that far in complex system to see what's going to be the best outcome. Somewhere we have to start guessing a little bit, using heuristics or some statistical model to pick what's the next thing we're going to do, right? And that's essentially what AI is doing. It's looking for patterns. It's very good at that, right? It's planning. It's trying to find good solutions. It's just nothing has changed really fundamentally, as far as I can tell, the last 30 years. It's just that we have vastly more data and far more computational power than we used to have in the past. So now we're just really way the heck better at it, right? But we're still just building statistical models and planning and looking into the future. That's what it's doing. So we're really good at finding patterns, automating menial tasks, classifying things like images, for example, but even that goes horribly wrong quite frequently. So this is not going to do a lot of things that we think it can do, and it's why, as far as I am concerned, it's far away from intelligence, right? These systems, they do what they're taught to do, and sometimes that is horrific, because they learn from data that is collected from a sexist, racist, severely biased past, and now we have racist, sexist, severely biased AI systems making decisions for us. But since they're made by a computer, they gotta be good, right? And we don't stop to think about these things. And that is part of where I go with the problems here in a second. But this is, I think AI and all of this have sort of hit peak hype right now. It's not gonna pan out as well as we think it is. Right, self-driving cars are not going to be here next year. They're going to start keep running people over. It's going to take the legal system a decade. I'm quite sure that they're going to be safer than the human driver. But the legal system is going to take decades to sort out the legal aspects of this. So it's going to take a while, right? So we've hit that. So I think the future is really bright. I think a lot of this is going to be very good for society. It's going to be good for all of us. A lot of menial tasks, a lot of other things that we didn't think were menial. We thought they were white collar, but they're kind of boring. It's going to go away. So I think that is a good thing. The key, though, is, of course, education, right? And this is not, I'm in computer science. We have, we train computer scientists. They get hired like gangbusters. Our programs have doubled in size just the last, I don't know, 5-8 years. Right, we have credit hours coming out our ears. It's terrible, really. Well, it's good, but terrible. But we see three things there, really. And we need to educate people with their bachelor's, master's, and PhDs. There's a huge need for that category of people. We need to train people that's already out of industry through master's degrees, for example. But it also turns out that most of the people in the industry that need some education are not computer scientists, right? They may not be able to join a CS program. They need enough training to do their job better, right? But they need a little more advanced training. That's what you can typically get from sort of coding for us kind of training outfit. So they need something between education and training, right? Now I can see this happening on a massive scale. These new AI systems that come out, all the automation, it's going to be far more advanced than using a power hammer or using a CNC machine or other kinds of things in factory automation. These people are going to need to be retrained, but they're going to need both education so they can understand why these systems do what they're doing, how to interpret what they're doing, how to take advantage of what they're doing, not just be trained on how to use them. Right? And I think that's going to be a fundamental change in how we deal with things. People are going to need to know more than what they did in the past. Right? And that's something that's going to affect us from K through 12 through university education. And we at the U, of course, can't solve this problem. Right? We have K through 12, we got MinSCU, we got our community colleges, we got us, and we got all kinds of other places. We need to figure out a game plan here, how we're going to be able to deal with this massive displacement. And cater to all of these needs that's necessary. And we in computer science, we can cause some of these problems, but we're certainly not going to be able to fix them. And that's where I think we're going to need a lot of help in making this happen. So I think we'll be fine. But I added this thing because there's another thing, if anybody wants to talk about it afterwards, that I think computing is leading to. It's not just AI automation and autonomy, it's also this notion of connecting work with the workforce through things like Uber, right? That work model, which is not really related to what we're doing, but that work model is going to lead to massive problems going into the future, I believe. And that's enabled by this kind of technology, right? But that's a societal policy issue that we're going to have to deal with separately. Thank you very much.
Preparing people to not only respond but also utilize technology and artificial intelligence is a challenge that Laura Kalambakidis identified during our visit from Minnesota's workforce.
If we add technology right now to improve the productivity of the workers we have, what are those jobs going to look like 5 years from now? Because those people, you know, the students who are coming out of high school and deciding on secondary education, they want to know what those jobs are going to be 5 years from now. And so what should they be training in? And that is a hard thing to do because it's hard for firms to forecast what they're going to need. And it's hard for the educational institutions to retool to provide those skills. But I think that's currently a challenge.
Part of that challenge is also making sure that the right information is reaching individuals when they're making difficult decisions about college, the labor force, technical schools. Aaron Sojourner, labor economist with Carlson School of Management, discussed the challenges of transitions for getting people into the workforce pipeline and making sure it's the right fit.
What I want to talk to you about today is that Minnesota families and work and people and businesses are making expensive mistakes at high consequence transitions points between systems, between sort of the K-12 system, the higher ed system, the workforce, as people move between these systems. And we're kind of in a golden age right now. We have a lot of new possibilities ahead of us that we haven't had, you know, even 10 years ago to help people make better decisions. And I think a lot of those will come down to harnessing available information in new ways and delivering decision support to people making hard choices about their lives and their resources. And I think it's a kind of a systems design perspective and like a individual decision making perspective. And so the questions I think we can ask nowadays that we couldn't really ask and answer before is how do we share information in a way that's very useful, very cheap, very scalable? Who has information that's valuable to whom, how do we get it to the right person at the right time, and in what form? So like in general, if you think about making decisions and making good decisions or bad decisions, like, so the US Department of Education a few years ago created this whole system called the College Scorecard that's meant to force accountability onto institutes of higher education, have them do a lot of reporting. My colleagues here from institutional research probably shake their fist at this maybe, but they do the hard work of like reporting this stuff to the feds, and now all the colleges and universities of the countries that take federal aid have to do that. And it's all processed, and now it's kicked back out. And so you can see if you're in Duluth and you're trying to choose, do I want to go to Duluth Business University or Lake Superior College? I can see the costs, I can see the graduation rates, I can see the salaries, I can see the debt burdens, how much are, you know, what share of students are paying down debt 2 years after graduation. Okay, that's the Office of Higher Ed at Minnesota's building tools, DEED is building tools, SLEDS is building tools that are knitting together different administrative data systems on education, K-12, higher ed, workforce. And the reality is that only about 70% of high school grads in Minnesota are going to college, so 30% are not. Even that's from SLEDS, you can find it online. Even among those who go to college and start, you know, only 70% are either graduated or persisting in college a few years later, 4 years later. So another 30% are dropping out. So, you know, we have this ethos of college for all, and we don't want to limit people's opportunities, but it's not serving a lot of people well. A lot of people are not being served well by this system, and helping them get better information, a better view of what happens if I go down that path or that path, I think will help them make better decisions. It's not trying to force people down certain paths, but just give them feedback like I get when I go to a restaurant to see, like, is this gonna be a good fit for me? What are my chances? How have other people like me in the past done who went down this path? And also a systems perspective on sort of, you know, encouraging tighter connections between these different systems. So employers to high schools. High schools know a lot about kids that employers wish they knew. Like, what are they good at? Who's dependable? And if we could strengthen those connections, it would help everyone. So that's another area. Just helping information flow in an intentional way to the right people at the right time. There's a lot of new possibilities, but there's like tons of scope for improvement, user design, like all kinds of better use of these tools.
Aaron's comments reflect the frustration that is felt by many who are working to bring people into skilled jobs, as we heard from Bob Kill during his interview.
We have to quit saying that a two-year technical degree is a consolation prize.
Education is more than something we provide to our youth. According to Laura Columbakidis, we need to consider it as an investment in our children and our future workforce.
Every community has a vested interest in making sure that the kids are well educated and can be productive, fabulous members of the community, as well as being able to work in the future. And so investing in that high quality early childhood education is in everybody's interest, whether you're a parent of one of those kids or not.
Jeffrey Maruyama, professor and chair for the Department of Educational Psychology, discussed with attendees the value of exploring and better understanding the causes for success, as well as ways to increase educational engagement early in life.
So what I want to really focus on is the changing workforce that we have and the challenges that we face. That just as a college professor, I feel like we're an inline user. That is, we get products that have been produced over 13 years, and they come to us with certain attributes. We have some time with them, depending upon what part of post-secondary education they're in, and then they head off into the workforce. One of the other things we realize is in today's information age, college ready is the same as career ready. So even if students choose not to go to college, they better come out of high school ready to go to college and have the choice of whether or not they want to go to college. College being broadly defined, including technical and vocational, as well as standard four-year liberal arts schools. So what I want to talk about then is what do we need to think about as not only our workforce doesn't grow, but it changes. It becomes more diverse. It includes increasing numbers of people who come from backgrounds that have not historically been successful in post-secondary education, and it produces people more in the lower income occupations than in those that we really think about as careers and living wages that would allow you to buy a house and raise a family. And you may be that as we think about an advantage of the increasingly diverse workforce, that workforce may allow us to perceive things in ways that others don't. I may run out of time here by giving this example, but in the turn of the 1900s, there's a man named Stonequist who talked about the marginal man, people torn between cultures. Later on, there was a concept by a woman named Claire Mayo, a psychologist, called positive marginality. That is, if I live in two cultures, I can translate across them, and things that make sense in one culture, I can take to the other culture in ways that they don't think about. So the challenge here that I want to talk about has to do with workforce. One of the other parts of this challenge is, if you look at, these are not new data, but things haven't changed, you'll see that about 3/4 of college students at the top 146 colleges come from families in the top income quartile. That is, we're not getting students from the bottom and middle income quartiles up into the most selective institutions. And that's a challenge. If we want to develop a workforce, we're gonna have to bring more people out of these into greater educational success. We think about the barriers to educational access. We can think about school readiness. We talked about early childhood. It's not just daycare, it's early childhood education that gets students ready for school. Secondly, school course taking. There's still some counselors who will tell students, take an easy class, get a good grade, it'll be good for your college. It's not. Take a hard class that challenges you, that's college level, and build your skills and get you ready to succeed in college. School achievement. We know that students who don't do well get discouraged, they drop out. College readiness, as I said earlier, college readiness is career readiness. We need to have a goal of all students college and career ready, and then college success. In order to be successful in our workforce, we need to have more students coming out of college and college of all types ready for 21st century information age careers. There's a lot of agreement across the educational communities on what some of the critical benchmarks are. These are from the Strive Together Network, which started in Cincinnati, but Generation Next, if you're familiar with the programming here, is a Strive type of program. Their benchmarks are kindergarten readiness, that is, start kindergarten ready to learn, read at grade level by the end of third grade, build social emotional skills through the middle school ages. This is a new one. Take algebra in eighth grade. I don't know if you know it, but the legislature mandates algebra in eighth grade. So some students take algebra in eighth grade and algebra in ninth grade because they aren't really ready. We have to balance individual differences in how students develop with these kind of general prescriptions we want. High school graduation, college and career ready, and then post-secondary success. And you'll see, like Northside Achievement Zone, you'll see virtually all places have some variants of these. Let me skip ahead to Dilbert. The boss says, someone sent me another anonymous email with a link to an article about the world's worst bosses. I get one of these emails every time I leave your cubicle. Did you think I wouldn't notice the correlation? And then Wally around the corner says, correlation does not imply causation. So the point here is, as I go back to the benchmarks, that we know these are predictive of success. We don't necessarily know that these are the causes of success. So it's not like we get all students taking algebra in eighth grade and they all end up on high school college ready. Part of the challenge of us as researchers, and you as those of you who are researchers and or practitioners, is how do we figure out what the causal elements are among all the things that are predictive of success? We use these as proxy variables, right? A proxy for graduating from college is starting kindergarten ready. Students that start ready are more likely to graduate from college. Students who can read at grade level are more likely to graduate. And I can go through them all. But we don't know which are causes and which aren't.
In order for communities to have the strong education systems that meet benchmarks like Jeffrey discussed, as well as to support the growth of a healthy workforce, they must have residents. As we look at the immigration of people to communities, Dave Kruger from the Meeker County Development Corporation discussed the importance of understanding newcomers while he participated in episode 3 of Vital Connections on air, Make It Litchfield.
And so if you want to recruit, if you want to retain, and you want those people to stay in the school district, create families, we need to understand them better and their wants and needs and for the community.
Recruiting and retaining new individuals is vital to communities. And Ryan Allen, associate professor at the Humphrey School of Public Affairs and past podcast guest, presented at the symposium and discussed the value of understanding migration of both U.S. and foreign-born citizens and workers.
It's well known now that we are facing some moderating population growth in the future, right? So these are data that I'm going to be discussing that come from the Minnesota State Demographer. You can see the map of Minnesota there that includes all the counties, and you can see the projected population growth rates between 2015 and 2045, right? So overall, the State Demographer tells us that we'll grow about 14% during this time period, our population will. In comparison, the U.S. will grow about 21%. Right, so we're certainly lagging in terms of the nation overall. And you can see this growth is going to be uneven. Right? So there's some regions in the state that are going to grow little, if at all. In fact, some of them may lose population over this time period, is what the projections tell us. There are others, largely around urban areas and in other metro areas, micropolitan areas, that are going to have more robust growth. But it's not true that any part of the state is going to be growing leaps and bounds, and perhaps looking really quite different than we have in the past. Demographers like to think about population growth, just to simplify this a little bit, as two streams, right? So on one hand, we have what demographers call natural change. That's births minus deaths, right? And then we have net migration, that is how many people are moving or leaving an area. And so what I've done with this graph, what the state demographer has done with this graph, is decompose these two parts of population change in a projected fashion, right? So there's a sobering thing. The blue line that you see here that's going down, the downward slope, that's natural change, right? We're gonna have more and more deaths and fewer births until around 2040 when we get to the zero point, right? And after that, it's gonna be a slight negative natural change in the state. Luckily, we have a positive net migration to our state overall, and you see that increasing over time and leveling off there in the 2050s or so, when I'll be a distant memory to most of you. So this is an important issue, and I raise this because natural change is hard to modify, right? We can think about policies that are going to have an effect on that, but it's like turning the Titanic, right? On the other hand, migration is more malleable. Right? It's more responsive to the political environment, it's more responsive to economic opportunities, and so on. And so that's where I want to put our attention now. I want to decompose that further into thinking about net migrants that are born in the United States and those that are born abroad. Right? And so what this chart shows you is that through the 1990s, we had positive net migration for both people born in the United States and people born abroad to the state of Minnesota. After that, the situation changed dramatically. We had negative net migration for domestic foreign folks, and we had positive net migration, continued positive net migration for international immigrants. Right? This trend may have changed. The most recent data that are not included here show positive net migration for both. Right? But I'm skeptical. I'm an academic. I'm skeptical. So I want to see more data before I'm willing to acknowledge a shift in the trend. But if this is the trend, what does that mean for our labor force, right? Well, let's talk about some labor force growth numbers, right? In the 1990s, in the 70s, 80s, and 90s, we had pretty robust workforce growth on an annual average, right? It looks pretty strong. It tailed off considerably, and it's projected to go even lower in the future, right? Under 0.5% per year on average growth. Why is this important? Labor economists tell us that this is a vital factor for explaining economic growth. In fact, the literature suggests it explains as much as 25% of the economic growth we've experienced as a nation recently is due to changes in our labor force. And that's an important issue. So let me wrap up with how I'm thinking about this, what this means for changes in policy and practice. If we want to have a more robust, resilient economy, we want to have a more robust, resilient workforce, what do we got to do, right?
Well, I think we need to attract more migrants, right? And if history is any guide, those migrants are disproportionately going to be foreign-born, right? Why did they come? Why would they want to come in greater numbers? I think we first have to think about economic fundamentals in our state, right? What are the economic opportunities that are here? But also what kind of disparities exist, right? We have some very well understood and publicized disparities in higher education, in home ownership, in wages and earnings. Those things we need to be very attentive to, right? But I also think we need to be attentive to the social environment that we have here. We have to be attentive to the political environment. We have to think about how newcomers, writ large, but certainly immigrants in particular, integrate into our communities. How do they become part of social networks? How do they become part of the fabric of our communities? And so on. And I think we're falling behind, frankly, as a state on this. I also think at a time when we should be attracting more immigrants to the United States, the policy language is in quite the opposite direction, right? And I, not to over-politicize this, I find that troubling from an economic perspective, right? Let alone a political perspective, that's a different conversation. But again, at the time when we should be admitting robust, in my opinion, number of immigrants, the best proposals that are coming out of Congress and certainly out of the President's administration are talking about halving, historically, in recent history, where we've been, right? So let me conclude on that cheery note. I think that there is hope for the future. I think that people are recognizing this is an issue that has to be grappled with. We're recognizing it on multiple levels, political, economic, and social. Right? And that's exactly where we want to be. Right? This is the conversation to be having.
Ryan is correct. This is the conversation to be having in order to keep our communities vibrant as well as our economy. Bill Blazer discussed the impact that an available workforce has on keeping a business in a community.
Frankly, if there's an employer who's trying to grow and the immigrant population allows that growth, that's even better, because one of the things we've discovered over the years is that when an employer or a business has the opportunity to grow and then can't get the workers that they need to have that growth, they're pretty quick to start looking for a new location for the business.
In addition to recruiting migrants, another way of boosting our workforce is reaching into untapped pockets of workers. And Bill Blazer discussed the importance of not only immigrants in the workforce when he visited our podcast, but also other underrepresented populations.
There are other parts of our workforce that are underutilized. I'm thinking about disabled individuals or certain parts of the African American community or the American Indian community where the unemployment rates are high. Even if immigration continues at its current rate or increases, there'll still be job openings and plenty of opportunities and, frankly, some urgency for Minnesota businesses to tap and to do a better job of employing folks with disabilities, American Indians, African Americans, veterans, older workers, and particularly older women.
Kelly Nye-Lingerman, research associate at the Institute on Community Integration, used her time at the symposium to discuss one of those pockets of potential workers, people with disabilities.
So one of the things, when I thought about all of the research and the activity that we do at our centers, is what could I provide to a mixed audience to sort of drop something in the bucket to say, hey, think about this. And my goal today for this session is really about getting people to see and consider people with disabilities as workforce solutions. We look and there are many, many challenges and problems and barriers, a number of things we've already talked about today, but I want to talk about a solution that we don't always think about and that doesn't always come top of mind, and that is including people with disabilities in the workforce as a meaningful solution. So these are really some of the headlines that we've seen about workforce shortages in all kinds of industries, from manufacturing to healthcare to education to technology services, is that it's not isolated in one industry per se. But one of the things that we don't often think about is that there's this hidden corner of the workforce and that we really haven't tapped into. And so when we think about sort of this gap and this disconnect to say there are these challenges, these limitations, these shortages of workers, is that where are we going to find them? How are we going to build capacity? And I really want to challenge people to think about people with disabilities, even significant disabilities, as being this hidden and untapped resource that we haven't figured out well how to leverage. So to share a little bit of data with you, this comes from the American Community Survey, and this is looking at the employment rate. So this is folks ages 21 to 64 across the United States who was employed at least part-time or above in the last year. So the employment rate for people without disabilities is at around 79%, and that's pretty consistent. So people with any disability, and that can be a wide spectrum, anything from physical, mental health, is about 36%, and people with cognitive disabilities, their employment rate is about 26%. And I include cognitive disabilities because that also scoops up the bucket of folks with intellectual and developmental disabilities. So you can really see that the employment rate, and if we dig deeper into things like labor force participation, there are huge discrepancies about who's in the workforce and who's not in the workforce. But what I hope this is also a clue about that there are more workers out there, and there really is this untapped resource. Another number to just take a peek at are folks who are not working but are also actively looking for work. Again, same data set from the American Community Survey, people with disabilities, any disability or cognitive disability. So those numbers don't look very huge, but at the same time, there are certainly opportunities to tap into folks that are looking for work as well. So one of the things I also want to point out and remind folks is that we really do have to think creatively about how to reach and tap in to populations of job seekers that aren't actively looking for work or maybe are not in the same spaces that we always think that they are at. But before I end my session today, one of the things that we do a great deal in our work is sort of public education about disability. And in talking with and working with employers, when people say, oh, people with disabilities, they're a workforce solution, there are a lot of challenges to that. There's a lot of narratives about that person's too disabled to work, accommodations are too expensive, I don't want to open myself up to litigation. And so part of that is we have to acknowledge, I think, the questions and the fears that do come along with including everybody in the workforce. And that's an important part of the work that we do. And although this sounds like a really simple solution, is that first and foremost, we have to challenge the stereotype and the narrative that people with disabilities don't work or people in poverty don't work. People with disabilities can and want to work, and there is resounding evidence of that. And so part of my goal here today is really trying to put that in the forefront and remind people that this is in fact a solution that is in front of us. The other thing to think about too is that oftentimes information and exposure can really combat those fears and some of those counter narratives that people hear, and that many accommodations that employers can make or that businesses can make or industries or educational settings can make really are low cost, no cost, maybe one time, and really can help you retain and attract qualified employees. And most of these pictures here are all folks from Minnesota, by the way. So a couple of quick examples, again, on workplace accommodations. I actually don't think we have anybody from Disability Services here today, but from sit-stand workstations to Android apps with alarms and breaks, to colored glasses for screen reading, again, low cost, no cost, one-time thing, help make the workplace more productive and more accessible to all kinds of employees. And they don't necessarily have to be complicated and expensive, and they don't necessarily have to open your organization or industry open to unnecessary litigation. I also have a note here about job coaching in person. We have a new job coaching app that supports some workers with disabilities without having to have a person right there with them all the time, so that's pretty cool. And the last sort of tech slide that I hear is that we've talked actually a fair amount of this today. The theme has sort of come out is that we need to move beyond just sort of focusing on costs all the time and talk about focusing on value as well. And that research that we do both at our center here in Minnesota and at many of our partners nationwide has shown that there's really significant social, emotional, economic benefits for individuals, employers, and taxpayers when people with disabilities are working, and that public programs and services, many of which provide critical services and supports to people with disabilities and their families, should work to facilitate and incentivize workforce participation for people with disabilities.
The Center for Integration offers assistance to employers who would like help in hiring people with disabilities. Go to our website to find their contact information. Regardless of whether it is an individual with a disability entering the workforce, a new immigrant, or a new graduate, there needs to be an investment in the individual and creativity in how we prepare people to take on a new job.
I think that educational institutions and firms, employers, are figuring out ways to do training in more flexible way, to be more flexible about training and credentialing. So maybe we don't need someone to do this 3-year program to be credentialed to do this job. Maybe we can bring them in as an apprentice and they can learn on the job. Maybe we can have a mobile training unit that goes somewhere to train people. Those are the kinds of things. It's this creativity in making those matches that I'm seeing.
Ken Bartlett, professor for the Human Resource Development Program in the College of Education and Human Development, brought attendees back to the human side of workforce challenges by discussing how we invest in individuals and challenging us to think about why we do the things we do.
You know, I premise my whole presentation with this simple thought, and I encourage us to change the way we look at things, because when we do that, the things we look at tend to change. And more specifically, what I'm advocating is a changing view of people. I guess I could use the academic term human resources, but I prefer to use the term people. The traditional view of people in organizations has been that there are costs associated. And I want to suggest that we focus more on the emergent strategic view of human resources, which is as the creator of positive return on investments, plural, many. But this is very difficult to do because there are many facets of the organization that are involved. And I think this is even more difficult if we want to only focus on elegant formula and economic models, which is why I think it is so impressive and important and exciting that we are here today taking a very interdisciplinary, theoretical and applied view of thinking of the workforce in Minnesota. So I wanted to show you this slide, allegations of plagiarism are never warranted towards me. This is ripped off from a slide deck from an introductory management textbook. And the point being is that almost every introductory human resource management or management textbook has this slide in it. Which makes me ask the question, what are we teaching all of our students? So when they become managers, when they become leaders in an organization, the dominant framework of how they view people in the workforce is one of all of these costs. So earlier today in our first presentation on changes in the workforce, we heard about some of the shifting demographics. Well, I'm one of those foreign migrants, I'd rather the term international, who came to Minnesota for work. And as someone who is originally from New Zealand, the rest of the world would say that I am from down under. Well, we're sick of being down under. And so I encourage you to question your frame of reference. Why do you call things the way you call things? We never refer to ourselves in New Zealand as being from down under. So I think this comes at multiple levels, be it at a workforce level or even at an individual worker level. Because I think many times our frame is one of, how can I get this person to do the work I want them to do? Rather than, what am I doing? What are we doing to improve people's quality of life at work so that they want to work hard on their own? And that's been quite a profound shift in management. But I think it also needs to occur at a workforce planning and development level as well. Because when we make visible investments in people, we're acknowledging value, we're fostering growth, we're showing appreciation, things that are important to each and every one of us. When we think of people, I want to make a slight distinction between the fields of human resource management and human resource development. You can get a degree in both of these areas at the University of Minnesota. Our colleagues in human resource management are in the Carlson School of Management. I'm a faculty member in human resource development, and we're in the College of Education and Human Development. And there's a reason for that. A number of years ago, a University of Minnesota alum, Patricia McClagan, a well-known management consultant, produced this diagram to highlight some of the differences between human resource development and human resource management. The pink are those activities that largely draw from education and human development to foster on helping people be better at work tomorrow than they are today. All of this is HR, and if you're involved in any aspect of HR, oversimplified version of this diagram is very much which will guide your day-to-day work behavior. But when we think of workforce development, part of the difficulty is that it encompasses such a wide range of activities, policies, and programs that tend to be thought about in a geographical context that have something to do with the creation, the sustainment, and the retention of a viable workforce that can support current and future business and industry. Much of the current discussion on workforce development tends to separate the layers. When we think of individual centering on training and education, those activities undertaken by an organization so that they stay globally competitive. And at a societal level, that we think about the future economic stability and growth of a geographic region. Much of this separation ignores the interconnections and the interconnectivity of development activity that does and need to occur at each of these levels. And again, it brings us back to somewhat of this arbitrary distinction between an investment and a cost. Because oftentimes we think that a lack of investment is nothing more perhaps than a missed opportunity. Current budget situation means that we can't invest in our workforce the way we would like to. Well, there's no harm in that, it was just a missed opportunity. Well, I would argue there are significant costs, and these are often equally difficult to contribute. We focus a lot on employee turnover, but it's not just those who leave, it's those who stay. What is their engagement level? What is the level of performance? Even highly measurable things like human error and accident. And I think as many of the previous presenters have touched on, there are significant costs at a societal level of limiting investment in individual lives, community, and indeed our environment. So this raises new questions. What kind of employee investment should we be talking about at what level? And when we make an investment, on whose behalf or for the sake of whom is that investment made? This is messy, this is complicated, and we often want to attribute who's getting the benefit so we can charge them the cost. As I conclude, I'm thinking of a recent report authored by Dee that said, while Minnesota's economy has recovered well, we have a lot of work to meet the workforce challenges of the future. A challenge is either an opportunity or a crisis, depending on your frame of reference. And I wonder, what if led by the University of Minnesota, we had a coordinated investment strategy that was the envy of the nation, that would help Minnesota become a world leader in addressing workforce challenges. And I leave us with this quote, which is on our program today.
Imagine if we did do this.
So let's do what Ken urged us to do, to change the way we look at things, because when we do, things we look at tend to change. Although we are facing workforce challenges, let's not lose sight of how Laura Collin-Bakitis described Minnesota's economy.
One of the state's greatest economic assets is the diverse economic base. Another of our great assets is our strong workforce. We have a well-educated workforce and very high labor force participation. So that's another asset for us.
And let us always remember this lesson from Ryan Allen.
I oftentimes make the mistake of being too myopically focused on workforce, and that creates an atomized vision of workers, right? These are our neighbors, they are members of faith community, they are our teammates, and we need to keep that in mind, I think. Too often we can get wrapped up in the abstract and lose sight of that. So I want to make sure that remains with us.
Thank you for joining us for part one of our special workforce wrap-up. Learn more about University of Minnesota Extension's Center for Community Vitality at extension.umn.edu/community-development. Remember that you can see all of the presentations from the symposium, including slides and full audio, at z.umn.edu/workforce-symposium. Make sure to follow us on Facebook and Twitter to stay up to date on new research and resources for communities and those who lead them. Please join us again for another episode of Vital Connections on Air.